Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On July 22nd, 1990, 13-year-old Deanna Merrifield was last seen in Killeen, Texas. In the early morning hours, she left her grandmother's house to visit her twin sister and was later seen getting into a dark sedan with two older teenage boys. She was never seen or heard from again. More than three decades later, Deanna's disappearance remains unsolved. Her family is still searching for answers and working hard to bring her home. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, Deanna Merrifield, we're going to get into this case, and there's two different stories here. There's a lack of investigation on behalf of the law enforcement agency in charge of investigating Deanna's case. And the other story is a sister's will to never give up on her sister and continue to fight to bring her home, which is why I'm happy to report that Deanna's sister, Melissa, worked with us on this episode to make sure that we had all the facts straight, because unfortunately with this case, there has been some misinformation and we're going to talk about that in the episode. We had some individuals who wanted to integrate themselves in this story and they were straight up lying. And Melissa has spent a lot of time disputing those testimonies because there were people who believed it and stopped looking for Melissa because of it. And we're going to try to reverse that today. We're going to talk about her case. We're going to discuss what wasn't done and what can be done, what might have happened, and where we go from here. I don't want to waste too much time on the intro. We actually have a massive blizzard coming through Rhode Island as we speak. I actually just got an alert a couple hours ago saying, hey, there's a travel ban as of 7 p.m. Right now it's 7:27. So yeah, sorry, I'm working. I'll go home right after this. But yeah, I want to make sure all of you know Deanna's name, know her story, and know how you can help. So let's dive into this week's case. Deanna Merrifield was born on February 2nd, 1977. She grew up in Killeen, Texas with her older sister, Amy, her twin sister, Becky, and their youngest sister, Melissa. The four sisters were close. Melissa says Deanna was bright and free-spirited, fun, smiley, sometimes a little loud. She was also fiercely protective of her sisters. Unfortunately, their home life was unstable. Their mother, Laurel, struggled with alcohol dependency and was often sick. This led to them being neglected and left them to fend for themselves. When the girls were still young, Laurel married a man named Roy, and according to the family, this made things worse. He was a bad guy, and it wasn't long before he was abusing the girls. In 1989, while Laurel was hospitalized for a sickness, Deanna and Becky told their grandmother that Roy had been sexually abusing them, and an investigation followed. Three of the four sisters eventually reported abuse by Roy. Only Deanna's report resulted in criminal charges. There wasn't enough evidence for another sister's case, and a different sister recanted out of fear. Even after all of this, Laurel stayed with Roy. And because of that, the girls could not remain in the home and were split up among relatives. Deanna and Amy went to live with their grandmother Edith in Killeen, and Becky lived with an uncle in town. Melissa was bounced between relatives before eventually returning to her mother's home. And Melissa tells us that the whole experience was traumatic. The sisters had been abused, And then there was the separation and the moving around that created a lot of instability. But Deanna wouldn't let the distance keep them apart. She'd walk miles from her grandmother's house just to see her sisters, even if it was only for a few minutes. She made sure that she was there to protect them any way that she could. In the fall of 1989, Roy was convicted of indecency with a child, and he received 10 years probation and was required to register as a sex offender. I'm not going to sit here and beat a dead horse. I've said this in probably 20 different episodes by now. I will never understand for the life of me how an adult can be convicted of a crime that involves some type of sexual element to it and not go immediately to prison. How does a judge look at a case and find that this person is guilty of indecency toward a child and allow them to stay amongst the community? 10 years probation? Really? They're going to be allowed to still live amongst that community? Sure, they have to register, but they're not going to serve any time in prison? Are you serious? There has to be some federal minimum standard where if you are convicted of a crime against a child, even if it's not sexual in nature, even if it's just child abuse, maybe you just hit them or struck them in a certain way. If you're found guilty, minimum 5 years. We have to set a precedent as a country where if you take advantage of a child in any way, shape, or form, and you are convicted of said crime, there will be no leniency. You are going away for an extended period of time to guarantee that at least during that duration, you don't hurt anybody else. That's my opinion. Please stop the video. Let me know what you think. I don't believe I'm going to get many people to disagree with me. If I'm the judge, it's not 10 years probation. It's 10 years serving in a prison. That's just me. I want to hear your thoughts. Now, at that time, Deanna was in the 7th grade at the Manor Middle School, and teachers described her as very bright, and she had even been placed in the gifted program in elementary school. But after the abuse and the unstable home, she stopped applying herself. She began spending a lot of time with a rougher and possibly older crowd. And I just want to make this very clear before I go any further into this case. For anybody out there who's misinformed about this, when you have something like this happen with a child, it is very common for it to derail them. That amount of trauma at that age, when you're still developing your brain, you know, that frontal lobe, it can completely derail your entire life. The damage is not just done immediately, it's long-term, and sometimes people never recover. So when you see children who have a very bright future go off the tracks and start making bad decisions, it is not their fault. It is the offender's fault. And more importantly, in this case, I'm just going to say it, and some of you may not agree with me, but Laurel failed not only Deanna, she failed all of her children. One thing to have a alcohol dependency, that is something that some people experience and it's hard to overcome. However, when three of your four children report that the person you're married to is abusing them and you choose him over them, I'm sorry, you're wrong and you're contributing to the problem. You could have made the right choice. You could have kicked his ass to the curb and you could have done the right thing and brought your daughters home, but you didn't. So in my mind, yeah, Roy's a scumbag. Laurel, you screwed up too. So in the spring of 1990, Deanna finished 7th grade, and that summer she stayed with her grandmother Edith and continued seeing her sisters whenever she could. On July 21st, 13-year-old Deanna stayed up late watching movies with Edith. At around 1 a.m., which was now July 22nd, Edith went to bed while Deanna stayed up. When Edith woke up the next morning, she went to Deanna's room and realized she wasn't there. All of Deanna's belongings were still inside, and there was no note. At first, Edith thought that Deanna may have gone to see a family member, so she began calling around to check. She contacted Deanna's mother, Laurel, who said that she had not seen or heard from her. Edith also called others, but no one knew where Deanna was. With no sign of her granddaughter, Edith went to the Killeen police and reported Deanna missing. She thought an investigation would begin, but nothing happened. The police immediately classified her case as a runaway. They did not investigate Deanna's disappearance. There were no interviews, no searches, and no media coverage. As far as Melissa can tell, the police appeared to view Deanna as a troubled teenager and assumed she would eventually come back, but she never did. Melissa, who was 11 years old at the time, said it was probably easier for the police to write Deanna's case off because Her own mother didn't even care. Melissa says she does not remember her mother or Roy being worried at all. According to her, they did not search for Deanna or speak with police about her disappearance. Deanna had been viewed as a thorn in their side, and Melissa believes they were relieved that she was gone. And just to double back to the law enforcement response here, I've talked about this 100 times. It's unacceptable, right? Deanna was barely a teenager. She had just turned 13 years old. No signs that she had ran away. Doesn't appear to be a history of her running away. And she just basically vanished in the middle of the night. Now, if you're going to enter her immediately into a system, that's a decision you can make internally, but there should be a full-scale response and search for her immediately, calling her friends, calling her family, visiting any known locations, trying to find her as fast as possible, even if it's only to relieve your own headache as a cop, right? To get this case off your desk, go out there and find her. Make the calls, go to the houses, do what you have to do to get her home. If you find her somewhere, she's not an adult yet. She doesn't have the freedom of leaving. Bring her back home, make a note of it, and now you can monitor her going forward. But to just assume, because of the lack of concern on behalf of the mother, who was not in her right state of mind, that this was something you didn't need to look into and that more than likely it was just a runaway, is not only unprofessional, it's unethical. And as you guys know by now, you're my part-time detectives, the first couple hours, the first 24 to 48 hours are absolutely critical. If the person is still out there and in that area, that's the time when it's going to happen. And if there's any chance of getting them home before something happens, that's the window. The longer you go, the less likely they are to be found. And that's why we're talking about it today. And Melissa also told us that whenever she would ask about Deanna, her mom and Roy would say that Deanna was just causing trouble. And they claim that she lied about Roy abusing her. And then, according to them, she ran away with Edith's help. And like I said earlier, Melissa was separated from her other sisters who were living with different relatives, so she did not have anyone to talk to about what had happened. So for years, Melissa believed that Deanna had run away and that Roy, poor Roy, was innocent of all the charges against him because she had no reason to think otherwise. But that's going to change. There's going to be a lot that she's going to uncover, and there's going to be information about Deanna's disappearance that nobody knew until many years later. We're going to talk about it right after the break. All right, quick confession. I don't have a cat, and you guys all know that by now, but somehow I'm surrounded by people who do, friends, family, and you guys. And once you start paying attention, you realize most cat food out there is kind of sketchy. A lot of mystery ingredients, a lot of dry pellets, and honestly, a lot of bad smells. If I'm being honest, it's one of the things I notice first when I step into someone's home who has a cat. It's either their litter box or the cat food. And the fact that I can't tell you the difference, that's a problem, which is why I'm happy to report this episode is sponsored by Smalls, because they can solve all those problems. If your cat could choose what they want to eat, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be dry pellets from a bag. Smalls fresh cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients you'd actually recognize from your own fridge. And it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. And getting started is easy. You just share a little info about your cat, their diet, health, and food preferences, and Smalls creates a personalized meal plan, so no more guessing in the pet food aisle. And even though I don't have a cat myself, the reviews say it all. One Smalls customer said, quote, "My cat was always so-so with their usual food, but she's very enthusiastic about Smalls. Her breath is much better, and she poops way less, and it doesn't smell disgusting like it used to, and as I was saying earlier, I think that's a win for them and for us." Smalls was started back in 2017 with a couple of guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends, and now they've served millions of meals to cats across the U.S., and after switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. And you can even add treats and snacks to your order, plus it's totally risk-free. If your cat won't eat the food, Smalls will refund you. So stop guessing which meals are going to upset your cat's stomach and switch to Smalls. For a limited time, because you're a Detective Perspective listener or viewer, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/detective. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/detective. All All right, we're back. And when Melissa became an adult, she moved away from Colleen and later started a family with her husband. In 2002, her mother died from complications of cirrhosis of the liver. And 4 years later, in 2006, she temporarily moved back to Texas with her two young children. Roy began helping her care for the kids, and at the time, Melissa still believed he was innocent of abusing her sisters. But then she found material on a computer that made it clear Roy was guilty. She immediately called one of her sisters, who confirmed that Roy had assaulted three of them. Melissa was obviously shocked and distraught that her whole childhood had been a lie, and that Roy had been around her children. So once she got them safely away from Roy, she began re-examining her childhood. If she had been lied to about Roy, she wondered if she had also been lied to about Deanna. She questioned if Deanna had really run away. And if she had, why wasn't anyone looking for her? Melissa said, quote, "It doesn't matter how you left. If a child is missing, they need to be found." Couldn't agree more, Melissa. Melissa had to know the answers to her questions. So in 2007, she went to Killeen Police. That's when she learned that Deanna's case had been closed not once, but twice, with Deanna being marked as a runaway. The first time the case was closed was in 1993, 3 years after Deanna disappeared. At the time, police received a phone call from a woman stating that Deanna was home safe and she could be removed from their list. The police believed the caller, and Deanna's case was closed without any follow-up. To this day, it's unclear who made that call. Melissa questions their motives and wonders if they truly had information about where Deanna could be. And I will just say, from a law enforcement perspective, this happens often. You'll have a missing persons case, and you'll have someone call in who will say, yeah, the person we had reported missing, they just returned back home, or we found them. You can remove them from NCIC, or you can close the case. At that point, dispatch or the officer will take the name, number, and address of said person. They'll make a report on it. They'll forward it to the investigating officer. And then it's on that investigating officer to, at minimum, call this person and tell them to come in so that they can confirm that the child has been returned and is safe. Or, I don't know, do a little police work, get in your car, drive over to the residence, and confirm that the child is in fact there. You got to put eyes on them yourself. Now, I will say there have been cases where I've had a runaway who goes missing once or twice a week. And, you know, it's a habitual thing. And what I will do if we're very busy is say, hey, put so-and-so on the phone. I'll get on the phone with them. Hey, are you okay? What happened? Where were you? Give me the information I need to make a small report. But that is far and few between. That is not a common occurrence. If this person has only done this once or twice, I'm going out there. I want to put eyes on them. Most importantly, I want to find out where they were. Not only for that occurrence, because what if they were being harbored by an adult? What if that person's a registered sex offender or has some other open cases that I'm currently looking into? Maybe even if they didn't hurt them that time, something could happen in the future. So I want to go pay that person a visit and let them know that I'm watching them. On the other hand, I also want to make record of where they were so that if they go missing again, I have another location or a person I can go speak with. They did not do that here. They just took the word of the caller without even noting who the caller was. Obviously, you guys know that's a huge mistake. And if they had done their job, more than likely they would have realized that there was more to the story than meets the eye, but they didn't. So here we are having to pick up the pieces. About a year after that call, Edith contacted detectives for an update. They told her for the first time that the investigation had been closed. She pushed for it to be reopened, and the police agreed, and Deanna's case was reclassified from a runaway to a missing person. Then in 1995, Edith followed up again, and she was told that the case had been officially closed because there was a, quote, lack of information, and because Deanna had turned 18 earlier that year. I don't even know how to justify this. I don't know how to explain it. I have never heard an officer saying, hey, because of a lack of information, we can't solve the case, so we're going to close it. I've definitely heard, because of the lack of information, we're not currently investigating it. There's no more leads, but you can't just close the case because you can't solve it. And then to add insult to injury, the fact that she's now 18 doesn't change anything. Yeah, it might not be a runaway complaint anymore, but it's still a missing person. Whether she's 15 or 25, if she's missing, she's missing. And Edith was right there with me. She begged for police to help, but they declined. And for the next 12 years, no one in law enforcement was looking for Deanna. But that changed in 2007 when Melissa went back to police, and after learning the case had been closed in 1995, she pushed for it to be reopened again. And fortunately, the police agreed, and for the first time, there was a full investigation. Detectives had started from the beginning. They ran checks on Deanna's name and social security number and collected DNA from Becky to compare against multiple databases. Unfortunately, there were no matches. At the same time, Melissa contacted the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, also known as NCMEC, and the organization worked with the police to develop investigative strategies and create age-progressed images of what Deanna might look like as an adult. Detectives also worked with Deanna's sisters to create a list of friends that she had at the time of her disappearance. They then began speaking with anyone who knew her in 1990. Through those efforts, which should have been conducted back in 1990, new information was revealed. And I want to break down what detectives learned for you guys. So after Edith went to bed in the early morning hours of July 22, 1990, Deanna left the house to see her twin sister, Becky. Becky was living about 2 miles away with their uncle at the Oak Springs Trailer Park on the 500 block of Dimple Street in Killeen. Deanna arrived at approximately 3:30 a.m., but she was not walking. She was actually in a dark sedan described as either brown or bronze with four doors. Not only was she in a car, but she also was accompanied by two males who were inside the vehicle with her. Deanna got out of the car and spoke briefly with Becky outside the home, and during that conversation, the uncle actually woke up and came outside, and he told Deanna to go back home. So she got back into the vehicle and left with the two men. After that, Deanna was never heard from again. Very little information is known about the men in the car. Becky did not recognize them, but she did describe them as white or Hispanic and as, quote, preppy teenagers, likely high school age. She believed Deanna might have mentioned that one of them was named Tony and that the other was his younger brother. These men have never been identified. However, other witnesses later reported seeing Deanna in a dark sedan with two men on that night. So it is believed that this lead is accurate. So there you are, a whole different story, right? When Edith initially comes in, the police automatically assume she's a runaway and there's no investigative efforts. If they had just put in the minimal amount of work, they would have learned this information at that time, immediately after it happened. What is the likelihood that if they had investigated this in 1990, when it first happened, that they would have figured out who those two boys were? I can tell you this right now. It's not a guarantee, but it's a lot higher probability than it is now. And so they have to live with that. They screwed up, because if they had done their job, I might not have to cover this story today. And maybe Deanna would still be with us. So back to where we are now, because Becky's working with law enforcement and she shared additional information with the police. She said that in 1993, 3 years after Deanna disappeared, she received a collect call from someone who identified herself to the operator as Deanna. Becky obviously accepted the call, but no one spoke. Now, the phone bill later traced that call to Horse Cave, Kentucky, and Deanna's family did have distant relatives in that area, but she didn't really know any of them, and the only way she could have known to go there was with Edith's help. But as I've said numerous times throughout this episode, Edith was the one who had pushed for years to keep the missing person case active. So for all of those reasons, Melissa doesn't think the collect call actually came from Deanna. But, you know, I just would pose this question. How many people knew that they had distant relatives in Horse Cave, Kentucky? I'll just be honest. I've never even heard of Horse Cave, Kentucky. So not only would this person have to have that information, which a lot of people didn't know, but they would actually have to be in Horse Cave, Kentucky, because as I said, the bill came back to that location. It wasn't like they just said they were from there. So it's a lot of coincidences, if you ask me. I don't know if it was Deanna, but it seems to me like someone with knowledge of Deanna and her family would have had to have made that call. Could it have been one of the distant relatives being cruel to the family, to Melissa? Possibly, but then the question would be why? On the other hand, is there a possibility that someone who knows what happened to Deanna, maybe even Deanna herself, did make the phone call just to hear Melissa's voice? I'm not trying to create false hope, but as I sit here right now with you, how can we rule that out completely? There's no way to do it. We may believe certain things, and I'm not trying to make us feel like that this is something it isn't, but just from a factual, logical standpoint, I'd like to have credible information to say with 100% certainty that there's no way it could have been Deanna. And as long as Deanna's still out there, there's no way we can say that. And I think that's a good thing. We have a few more things to cover in this case, including a possible sighting of Deanna in 2000 and 2002. We're going to talk about it right after the break. You've heard me talk about Hungry Root before, so you know how much I love it because it truly simplifies my life. As a busy parent and someone who works a lot of hours, it's been such a game changer when it comes to reaching my health goals by doing all of my weekly food shopping with Hungry Root. Hungry Root plans all of my meals and groceries for the week, fills my cart, and delivers everything I need to eat healthy every day, all while fitting my health goals, dietary preferences, and budget. Just 2 days ago, I had the grass-fed ribeye steak. Absolutely delicious. I also had my go-to side. I've talked about it before. It's their microwave russet potato. If you didn't tell me that it was microwaved, I wouldn't know the difference. It tastes exactly the same as a boiled potato or a baked potato. So strongly recommend you check it out. Don't knock it till you try. I promise you're going to love it. And then as another side, I had some cucumbers. And to satisfy my sweet tooth, I had the sweet fish gummies from Sweet Treats. Game changer. Loved it. It was convenient, tastes good, and it fit my health goals. Sign me up. And unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now offers 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every week, with many ready in under 15 minutes or less. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's insanely easy to find options that fit everyone's taste and nutrition goals. Hungry Root holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high-fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, and offer organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. I have no doubt that you're going to love Hungry Root as much as I do. You just have to try it. And for a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. Once again, that's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. Don't wait. Try it now. You won't regret it. So we're back, and detectives continued speaking with people who knew Deanna. One friend claimed that Deanna had visited them sometime between 2000 and 2002. They said that Deanna had several tattoos, including a large tattoo on her neck with her name, and that she did not want to be found. At the time, this appeared to be a strong lead, so detectives attempted to verify this information, but the friend stopped cooperating with them. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because despite the lack of corroboration, the tattoo description was entered into Deanna's missing person profiles in multiple databases. That information led many people to believe that Deanna could still be alive and in hiding, even though the claims had not been verified. Now, even though this person ended up not cooperating with law enforcement, Melissa, again, kudos to her for not taking no for an answer, was able to track this person down and spoke with this so-called friend on multiple occasions in the hopes of corroborating the information. But the friend's story changed every time she spoke to them, and eventually they finally admitted that they were lying, and this lead was officially ruled out by detectives. But unfortunately, the damage had already been done. To this day, Melissa is still working to have the inaccurate information removed from Deanna's missing person profiles. She wants people to understand that her sister has not been seen since July 22nd, 1990, and as far as she knows, she did not have any tattoos. When this case was reopened in 2007, police also spoke with Roy for the first time, which is absolutely astounding to me. You have someone who was implicated in a crime against your victim, and yet you wait until 2007 before speaking with him and confirming that he had an alibi for the night in question. However, even though he's an absolute scumbag, I will say he was cooperative with law enforcement and even agreed to take a polygraph. It's unclear exactly what he told police. However, we know he wasn't named as a suspect. So for this story, I'm going to assume that he was vetted and cleared. And just to add on to that, because it means more coming from Melissa than it does from me, she's the boots on the ground. She told us that for a long time, she did believe that Roy was involved in Deanna's disappearance. But today, she realizes a number of things would have had to align for him to be responsible. For instance, he would have had to know that Deanna had left the house in the middle of the night and went to see Becky. And Melissa went on to tell us that, no doubt about it, Roy is a bad person. And frankly, she would love to be able to blame him for what happened to Deanna. But unfortunately, she believes there is more than one monster in this story. And Melissa told us that after Deanna's case was reopened, she hoped that it would finally lead to answers, but instead, the case slowly lost momentum and eventually went cold. However, Melissa continued investigating on her own, and she spoke with her sisters, her uncle, and any of Deanna's friends that she could locate, trying to piece together Deanna's last movements. Unfortunately, over time, Melissa came to the belief that Deanna likely died on July 22, 1990. She believes something happened after Deanna left Becky's home. Now, she does not know whether it was foul play or an accident that was covered up, but to put it bluntly, she believes her sister died that night. And because of that, her focus has now shifted to bringing Deanna home. As the years passed, Melissa continued pushing for a full investigation. And finally, in 2005, a new detective was assigned to Deanna's case. Now, the good news here is that Melissa said this new detective has been a godsend to their family. She described him as motivated and committed to finding answers. He has also worked closely with Melissa's private investigator, who volunteers with the private investigators for the missing. And because of their efforts, there has now been new movement in the case, and three searches were held in late 2025 and early 2026. Unfortunately, Deanna was not located during either of those searches. Still, Melissa viewed their efforts as progress. Locations were ruled out, and for the first time in decades, active steps were being taken, something she had not been able to say for the past 35 years. And I couldn't agree more. Although it's demoralizing to have these searches conducted and nothing was found, it's something you have to check off the list. And I've talked about this in a lot of cases. Before you figure out what actually happened, you have to go down some leads that are going to lead nowhere. And it may seem like it was a waste of time, but in reality, you're crossing theories off the list. And the more theories you cross off, the less possibilities you have, and you can focus on what really happened. So I agree with her, and I'm not a rah-rah guy. The fact that they're crossing locations off their list, those are less places you have to think about and wonder, could Deanna be there? So I agree with her. This is absolutely progress. So today, the investigation into Deanna's disappearance continues, and there's more momentum than there has been in decades. Melissa hopes 2026 is the year they get the break they need, but even if it's not, she will keep investigating alongside the lead detective and the private investigator until Deanna is found, until they bring her home. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, and I want to mainly focus on two theories. One being that Deanna ran away with the help of Edith, and she did that because maybe she realized she was hanging out with the wrong people, making bad decisions, and overall, there were just too many bad memories in that area. So they made the conscious decision together to make this elaborate plan, and maybe Edith pushing for this case to stay open was just all a plot to make it look like this really was a missing persons case. Now, there are some holes in that theory, the biggest being that all of Deanna's belongings were still at the home. So if she did do this, she would have basically had to start fresh where she didn't take any of her clothes, any of her items, and just went down there with whatever she had on her back, knowing that whenever she got there, the people in Kentucky would be able to help her get some new things, which is not completely out of the question. But I would also say that years later, she could have came forward and let the people closest to her know that she was okay and she was just in a place where she didn't want to be found by anybody else. I would like to think, based on how close she was with her sisters. If that had happened, her sisters would not be trying to find her today. Melissa would not be connecting with us, trying to locate her. She would say, okay, I talked to Deanna, I'm just going to go away, and we wouldn't be covering this case on Detective Perspective, but here we are. So clearly, Deanna hasn't reached out to anyone, which brings us back to that collect phone call. I still have some questions about it, and if I were investigating this case, I would be looking more into that to see what I could find, specifically going and talking to these distant relatives. What were their relationships with Edith at the time when this occurred? Is there any information down there from neighbors or friends of these distant relatives that would suggest there was a young girl down there at this time who looked like Deanna? That would be a very simple question to ask. You go to local restaurants, you go to neighbors, you show them a picture of what Deanna looked like at 13 years old, and you ask people, hey, did you see any of these people hanging out with a girl who looked like this? Now, this may lead nowhere, but this is just another thing that needs to be checked off the list, just like those searches I mentioned in the story. Until we go down there and pull on that thread, we don't know where it's going to lead. And having a collect call from this remote area in Kentucky, when I have to assume that not many people knew about these distant relatives, to me is a pretty big coincidence. And there could be a distant relative down there who heard about the story, who knew from Edith that Deanna had disappeared. And it could have been a young kid who was just dumb, making a stupid decision, and decided to make this crank phone call to upset some people. And that might be the end of it. But the only way to really know is to go down there and put some pressure on people. Even if it's a cousin or a distant relative, you sit them down and you say, hey, listen, did you make the collect call? Was it a bad joke? You probably regret it now. If you did, just come clean, because there's people down in Texas who still believe that their sister's out there. And this would just be one more thing we could cross off the list of many things we have to do in this investigation. You're not going to be in trouble. We just want the truth. And there is a strong possibility that's what happened, but we don't know until we officially go and find out. Other than this collect call, there's no evidence to suggest that Deanna went anywhere else. And as a 13-year-old girl, I don't think that's what happened. If she's not in Kentucky, then I think this theory is officially ruled out. She didn't have any connections anywhere else. She was last seen with teens in the area. And speaking of those teens that she was seen with late at night, if you look at that factual information with Becky, you do have to ask yourself, if there's any truth to this theory that she ran away, why did she go to Becky's house at 3:30 in the morning? Was this a common thing? If it wasn't, is there a possibility that this was Deanna's way of saying goodbye to Becky before she left? If she had done this all the time, then again, another thing you can rule off the list and move on to the next theory. And speaking of the second theory, that's the one that is the most likely in this scenario. And this is right from Melissa's mouth, so I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know. If Deanna had done this before and she had been out late at night in the past, and we can confirm that, and she was with these two boys, I do believe that what Melissa is saying has a lot of validity to it. There could have been something that occurred that evening, whether it was foul play or an accident, and these young boys or somebody else that they met up with decided to cover up what had happened because they didn't want to be implicated in a crime. This is exactly what happened, in my professional opinion, in the Judy Rawlings case out of North Carolina. I covered it on Breaking Homicide. I've talked about it on Mile Higher. It is absolutely, in my professional opinion, what happened. A couple boys got together that night. Something bad happened. And my belief is that they realized Judy was going to tell on them and they decided to kill her. Now, in this case, it's a little different because we don't have a body. So we can't put together those puzzle pieces. But that is a real possibility here, that something bad happened, even if it was unintentional. And that is why we haven't found Deanna to this day. The other possibility is that after Deanna was dropped off by these teenagers somewhere else, maybe these two teens aren't involved at all, that she met up with another individual. And either that night or the next day, something again possibly happened, whether it was foul play or an accident. So even though we potentially have two suspects, maybe they're just another piece of this story. The only pushback I would have there is if they were not responsible and they knew that they had dropped Deanna off at some other location with some other person, you would think they would have come forward and said, hey, we don't want to be blamed for something we didn't do. So just so you know, because people saw her with us, we dropped her off. We can show you where we dropped her off, and we can tell you, or at least describe to you, who she was last seen with. These two boys have not done that. So because of it, I have to believe that somehow they are directly involved. And if that's the case, how do we find them? We already know that detectives had looked into Deanna's friends and their circle, and Melissa has also done a lot of legwork, and unfortunately, there's been no luck yet. But there has to be someone from that area who knows who these two individuals are. And the one thing I would say is don't get caught up on the name Tony. Becky could have been wrong. Don't get caught up on the fact that they were brothers. That also could be wrong. What we're looking for is two young boys who were possibly white or Hispanic who lived in the area of Killeen, Texas. It doesn't have to be Killeen, could be a surrounding community, in July of 1990. And one of these two boys were known to drive a brown or bronze sedan, a four-door sedan. That is something that if you're from that area during that time, that should stand out to you. I have to imagine that Deanna wasn't the only person who ever took a drive in this car. Someone out there has to know these two boys, has to know this vehicle, and for some reason, they haven't come forward yet. And I can't tell you why, but there is a reason to it. I think as long as we keep the heat on and we keep bringing attention to the story, it's going to pop. Something's going to register. Someone's going to finally decide to do the right thing. And we're going to solve this one. I really do believe it. And it's going to take someone out there who hears or watches the story to say, yep, that rings a bell. I didn't know there was a connection there. I didn't know Deanna's story, but I know that car and I know those boys. So I want to make sure you guys all have the most important information. So I want to recap it for you. Deanna Merrifield was last seen in the early morning hours of July 22nd, 1990 in Killeen, Texas, getting into a four-door sedan with two unidentified males, and she has never been seen or heard from again. Now, at the time, Deanna was 13 years old. She was 5'4", approximately 115 pounds, with blonde hair and hazel blue eyes. Today, she would be 49 years old. Melissa and the investigative team are working to identify the two individuals Deanna was seen with that night, and they believe she likely knew them, but their identities remain unknown. Anyone who knew Deanna in 1990 or earlier is asked to come forward, even if they believe the information is minor. Because there was so little investigation done in the beginning, even the basic details could matter in this case. If you have any information about Deanna or her disappearance, please contact the Killeen Police Department at 254-501-8891. You can also reach the family at findingdeanna.com. My final words, as always, go out to the friends and family of Deanna, specifically Melissa. Melissa, thank you for allowing me to cover your sister's story. I know this is something very important to you, and I'm sure the decision to let me talk about it is not something you take lightly. And I'm hoping that I was able to correct some of the misinformation that had been put out there. I'm hoping with the community that's listening and watching right now, we can really engage with the story in the comments section. Make sure you like the video. Make sure you hype it up. I guess that's a new thing. So that more people, whether they know about me or not, hear about Deanna's story, because that's how we're going to solve this case. And I'm really hoping that someone who knew Deanna in 1990 and knew these boys comes forward and says, hey, I didn't think it was important, but you might want to look into so-and-so because they owned a car that kind of sounds like the one you're describing. And with that little breadcrumb, we can get to this person's name, their date of birth, where they're from, and maybe see what they've done not only before Deanna's disappearance, but after. That's all it takes to be right back here letting you guys know that we solved this case and the people responsible are behind bars. And I hope that happens sooner than later. We're over 3 decades at this point. Far too long for this family. They deserve answers, and I'm hoping we can give them to them. Until next time, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
Hello. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.